You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. And this month's issue features Gwyneth Paltrow on the cover. Now here's Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones with the editor's letter. In the photo, Ariana Grande, Radhika Jones, and Cynthia Erivo at a party to toast the cast and creative team of Wicked on February 10th at the West Hollywood Edition. I always love Michelle Ruiz's cover profiles because she packs so much life into every sentence, and she gravitates to subjects with very packed lives. This month, Michelle talks with the eternally fascinating Gwyneth Paltrow, who, just when you think she might have receded, not into irrelevance, never that, but comfortably into the furniture, shows up somewhere unexpected, like, say, the Bal des Debutantes in Paris, with her daughter, Apple, or making out with Timothée Chalamet in photos on the internet from their new movie, Marty Supreme, directed by Josh Safdie. And then, like magic, she's our main character all over again. Michelle visits Paltrow at home in Montecito, where they talk business, goop, and pleasure. Her life as an empty nester, rebranded in rose-colored Gwyneth style as a free bird. After the wildfires in Los Angeles, Vanity Fair committed to supporting two local organizations helping affected families and industry professionals get back on their feet. Baby to Baby, which provides families in need with essential supplies from diapers and formula to clothing and blankets, and the Motion Picture and Television Fund, which offers emergency financial support and counseling to members of the entertainment community who have been impacted. Recovery from such a disaster doesn't happen overnight, so part of our commitment includes keeping attention on the city's efforts to regroup and rebuild. In this issue, we feature a portfolio of haunting images by Stuart Pally, who began photographing wildfires in 2012 as an intern at the Orange County Register. Over the years, he has gotten to know firefighters and their world, worked as a contractor for the U.S. Forest Service, and gone through formal wildland fire training. Sadly, in that time, there has been no shortage of material for his lens. His goal in documenting fires, as he tells senior Hollywood correspondent Anthony Bresnican, is to help people better prepare next time and help make firefighters' jobs easier in educating the public. The pictures featured here range from the Palisades fire's initial spread to the wasteland it and the other major blazes left behind, as cleanup crews and homeowners re-entered the territory to sift through the wreckage. Stewart's photographs are both unflinching in their proximity to the flames and assured in their portrayal of resilience. If you would like to donate to Baby to Baby or the MPTF, please visit their websites at babytobaby.org and mptf.com. Here are some of the issue's contributors. George Cortina, Gwyneth Everlasting. In dressing Gwyneth Paltrow, Cortina looked to Catherine Deneuve for inspiration. The location helped as well. The house was the perfect backdrop to fit the muse. The stylist, whose recent work includes Vanity Fair's 2024-2025 Hollywood cover, also has a pajama line with Anderson and Shepard, and a sunglasses collection with Jacques-Marie Mage. Michelle Ruiz, Gwyneth Everlasting. Ruiz, a frequent Vanity Fair contributor, met Gwyneth Paltrow for morning coffee in her kitchen in the quietly luxurious paradise of Montecito, California. It makes the story so much more intimate to spend time with a subject at home in their natural habitat, she says. Ruiz is completing a novel inspired by another local, Meghan Markle. Zoe Bernard, God Complex. I've been totally fascinated by the vibe shift that's underway in Silicon Valley. It used to be famous for being one of the most godless places in the country. Today, entrepreneurs and venture capitalists are embracing religion, says Bernard. A feature writer and 2024 Omidyar Network reporter in residence. Ned Rogers, Gwyneth Everlasting. A photographer and director based between New York and Paris, Rogers worked with Steven Meisel for 10 years while launching his own career. He tries to approach each project as a character study. Stuart Pally. Pally is a Southern California resident and photojournalist who has long been interested in the collision of human development and climate change. When the flames of wildfire are long gone, the psychic wounds are still fresh. No cars, no kids playing on the street. Even the songs of local birds were gone. There were no trees intact to hold them, says Pally of the aftermath of the January fires in Los Angeles. Now this from Rebecca Ford. Young, restless, with beef, and now The Last of Us on his resume, young Mazzino proves he's up to a challenge. With photograph by Nick Riley Bentham, showing Mazzino wearing high fashion, all black clothing and shoes. After he filmed the first season of Beef, young Mazzino slipped away to Spain. He had no idea that the 2023 limited series with Steven Yeun and Ali Wong would make him a breakout star. But after Mazzino earned an Emmy nomination, he suddenly saw possibilities opening up. "I'm still perplexed by everything," says the actor. "I don't know where this world is headed, but it seems to get more and more surreal." Mazzino recently took another major trip, bouncing from Tokyo to Indonesia, because he just finished the second season of the wrenching zombie hit The Last of Us, which premieres April 13th. "I never judged my character, but he's a bit of a Boy Scout," says Mazzino. "He definitely tapped into the brighter, warmer side of myself, because I think I'm by default a little darker than him spiritually." Growing up the son of Korean immigrants in Silver Spring, Maryland, Mazzino felt like becoming an artist was an outlandish decision. He kept quiet about his love of theater. "I didn't want my friends in athletics to know I was doing the musical, so I never told anyone until they'd see me on the stage," he says. "I was dealing with an existential crisis before I even knew what that was." After dropping out of college, Mazzino decamped to New York, where he worked as a business analyst and studied at the Stella Adler Studio of Acting. When he registered with SAG-AFTRA, he discovered there were too many actors with his given name, Christopher Kim, so he went with his Korean name, Young, and a surname inspired by Eric Mazzino, a character in the South Korean webtoon Tower of God. His ideal is to not just get to the top of this tower, but to leave the tower and be under the real stars, Mazzino says of his namesake. "That name was, in a way, to empower myself to strive for better and be greater than I felt." Even after finding success, Mazzino isn't sure how he fits into Hollywood as a Korean-American actor. "I do find myself in this weird kind of in-between," he says. "How selective can I be when I'm already in this weird space?" Lately, he's been spending time in Maryland with his family. Other than that, he lives nowhere in particular, though he's thinking about returning to New York. He just had a small role in the A24 thriller Opus. He'd love to work with Hirokazu Koreeda, Derek Cianfrance, and Terrence Malick someday. His mission, strange as it sounds, is to be uncomfortable. "I need to find myself in a room with people that are way beyond more talented than I am, because that's the only way I think I can really grow," Mazzino says. "I constantly want to be in a position where it's daunting." Here's what's trending. High Wire. Wind your way into an artist's imagination with Ruth Asawa Retrospective, a celebration of the modernist six-decade career spent bending notions of surface, volume, and perception. In the photos, Ruth Asawa poses with her Wire sculpture II in 1956. In the trending items, Fine Line, Sakai Pullover, Fernando Jorge Earrings, Dolce & Gabbana Shirt, Issey Miyake Pants, Roz Evergreen Styling Cream, Crate & Barrel Alfred Vase, Gigi Burris Beret, Bottega Veneta Ring, D'Ultima Shrug, Louis Vuitton Dress, Kite Skirt, Ferragamo Tote, Jill Sander Earth Perfume, ELF Cosmetics Sponge Set, Asawa Retrospective, edited by Janet Bishop, and Cara Mains, published by Yale Books, Marcel Shoes, Cartier Watch. And this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, In Bloom, with photograph by Peter Langer. Dior Fine Jewelry, Dior Mille Dentelles Necklace. In 1948, seeking a place to relax after his sudden rise to fame, Christian Dior purchased Moulin du Coudray, an old mill at Mille-la-Forêt, near Fontainebleau. Ensconced in the property's lush gardens, which a 1951 Vogue story described as designed after no visible plan but color, he found both inspiration and solace. Like the couturier himself, this delicate collar necklace takes its cues from the natural world. The elegant piece, featuring an 8-carat yellow diamond, bestows sunny days to wearers and admirers alike. Aaron Vanderhoof writes on books. Other words, Viet Thanh Nguyen explores what it means to be an outsider. Viet Thanh Nguyen, photographed by Jean Glover. In December 2023, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen had something he felt needed to be said, and luckily, a platform of unusual gravity on which to say it. Earlier that year, he was tapped to give the Norton Lectures, a nearly century-long Harvard series in which an artist addresses the public 6 times over the course of a year. This April, Nguyen will release To Save and To Destroy, Writing as an Other, an edited compilation of the lectures, preserving their piercing insight into the dilemmas faced by outsiders working in an insider literary culture. There is a task and a purpose for those who believe in literature. There is important work for us to do, he says. For those of us who are concerned about the injustices of our society, whether it's injustices being committed domestically or overseas in our name, there's a total relationship between beauty, art, truth, and justice. Nguyen is known for writing that distills the experiences of Asian Americans and addresses the Vietnam War, its complexities, and its aftermath, including The Sympathizer, 2015, which became an HBO limited series in 2024. The collection weaves in the work of those who inspire him, like Maxine Hong Kingston, Jeffrey Paul Chan and Kin Chin, along with literary giants including Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Herman Melville, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Ralph Ellison. Nguyen had initially drafted the series while in Paris the previous summer. October 7th happened literally between the second and the third lecture. So I felt I had to address that and all of its consequences, he says. In a few weeks, he wrote a skillful argument urging Asian Americans to see a reflection of themselves in the Palestinian struggle. I felt like there was an organic relationship for me to Palestinian thought and anti-colonial thinking that was deeply tied into the Vietnam War and to me becoming an American. Though the lecture did occasion an audience interruption when it was delivered in December 2023, it fit comfortably with what he had initially planned, a series of emotional tales that makes palpable his intellectual understanding of an artist's role in the political discourse and the way politics works its way into art. We want the writer and the artist who will tell us that art will save us, but it's competing against this human impulse to destroy, he says. Art can illuminate that process in ways that are not there to make us feel better, but for us to realize how deeply embedded this impulse for destruction is. If we can realize it, then we can save ourselves. And this from Keziah Weir, Six-Pack, Books That Plumb the Breadth of Human Desire. Sky Daddy, Kate Folk's premise should not work, and yet it's utterly delightful and even profound. A woman with a Boeing 737 kink is driven to form an everlasting bond by way of a plane crash, published by Random House. My documents. Following terrorist attacks, the U.S. government begins interning Vietnamese Americans in Kevin Nguyen's trenchant and quick-witted exploration of racism, ambition, and family ties. Published by One World. Audition. In Katie Kitamura's signature biting, sleek prose, a young man and an older married actress meet, to ominous effect, in a cafe. The book's second half upends and concretizes relationships, published by Riverhead. Early 30s, from Vanity Fair alumnus Josh Duboff, a warm, funny story of dear friends navigating New York careers. Victor, a celebrity profile writer, and Zoe, a fashion entrepreneur, and relationships, published by Scout Press. When the Going Was Good, written in his signature gait and filled with glorious details, Graydon Carter's memoir recounts the former Vanity Fair editor-in-chief's 25 years at the helm of this magazine, published by Penguin Press. The Float Test. Lynn Steger Strong brings together a quartet of adult siblings in sticky, strange, beautiful Florida, where family secrets, including a long-held sisterly resentment, threaten to rise from the deep. Published by Mariner. My Stuff, Treasure Trove. For the Glitterati's go-to jeweler, Jessica McCormick, diamonds and dogs are a girl's best friend. Style File, daily uniform, Citizens of Humanity jeans and a white t-shirt. For walking, New Balance sneakers. To bed, Olivia Van Halen silk pajamas. Wristwatch, Apple Watch with a Hello Kitty face. Beloved jewelry, it's hard to choose one favorite, similar to choosing a favorite child. But if I had to pick, diamond gypsets. For pleasure, reading Playground by Richard Powers. Watching Slow Horses, listening to Tracy Chapman. On beauty, face wash, Raya Golden Nectar, Manuka Honey Enzyme Cleanser. Serum, Dr. Barbara Sturm Hyaluronic Serum. Daily makeup, Westman Atelier. Hairbrush, Le Bon Brosse. Perfume, Carlos by L'Objet. Workout, Pilates in the Clouds and Box Clever LDN. The menu, morning cup, coffee. Indulgent drink, wine. Takeout, anything from Michiko Sushino in Queen's Park, London. At home, recent edition, Rick Owens chair. On the bed, a Noah Blanket Company blanket. On the table, scarlet and violet flowers. Stationery, Memo Press. Artwork, again, like choosing a favorite child, but I particularly love my pieces by Sally Mann and Louise Bourgeois. Aroma, the signature reset candle by Surface, a new candle from New Zealand with manuka, grass, and a touch of smoke. It's heaven, and reminds me of paradise. Furry friend, Buddy, the most beloved gray staffy. And moving on to politics. Anatomy of a Fall. Inside the First Week and Final Hours of the Harris Campaign by Chris Whipple. In his new book, Uncharted, the author dissects the 2024 presidential race. Here, he offers fresh reporting on the genesis of Harris's campaign and its sorrowful conclusion. The drama began the week before President Biden bowed out. At the time, Kamala Harris was navigating a political minefield. Any hint that she was plotting to replace the president could have been politically fatal. But while Harris was lying low, her political operation was working behind the scenes. Her chief of staff, Lorraine Vols, had been thinking about a contingency like this since November 19, 2021. That was when the president, under Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, had voluntarily transferred his powers and duties to Harris while he underwent a colonoscopy. It concentrated Vols' mind. She and her staff needed to be ready for anything. Still, taking Biden's place on the ticket was a lot more complicated and fraught than being the acting president for a day. To prepare, Harris's team launched a stealth operation. They recruited people with no direct connection to the vice president. On Thursday, July 18th, 3 days before Biden made his decision to step aside, a veteran Democratic operative heard from Stephanie Shryock, the former head of Emily's List. "I got a call to help the Harris campaign come up with an if-he-drops-out plan," this operative told me. "Can you take a look at all the rules? What we would actually need to do in terms of signatures?" They 100% did not know at that point. They were like, "We just feel like we should put a plan in place. Maybe something happens." We were all very careful that this was not Kamala. This was, if someone, Biden, wants to drop out, we desperately want a woman president, and us women have to be there. That was the framing. Other Harris allies were also wrangling prominent Democratic senators to make a promise. If Biden did not retreat by Monday, July 22nd, they would call on him publicly to do so. Even at this late date, Nancy Pelosi, who'd been putting her own pressure on Biden, was thought to oppose a coronation of Harris. She wanted a primary. Barack Obama reportedly wanted one, too. And he was said to favor a governor, not Harris, as the nominee. But as Biden weighed his options at his Rehoboth Beach house that fateful weekend of July 20th through the 21st, he was practically alone. The only counsel he was taking was from close aides Steve Ricchetti and Mike Donilon. On Sunday, just a little after noon, Biden called Harris. The vice president, wearing sweatpants and a Howard University hoodie, was in the kitchen of the vice presidential mansion at the U.S. Naval Observatory. The second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, was in California. Harris's niece, Mina, was visiting, and her two daughters, Harris's grandnieces, were sitting down to do a jigsaw puzzle. Her cell phone buzzed. "Hello, Mr. President," she said. "Listen," said Biden, "I've decided I'm not going to run." Harris sounded dumbfounded. She replied, "Are you sure? Are you sure you want to do that?" The president was sure. Biden hung up, but he called back to say the White House would announce his decision soon, and he would follow up with a tweet endorsing her. At 1:46 p.m., the White House released Biden's statement. At 2:13 p.m., he sent out the tweet. Now that Biden had actually ended his campaign, Harris would have to seize the nomination. She'd struggled with staff turnover during her first 2 years in office. But by 2024, she'd assembled a strong team, led by Voles, Sheila Nix, a senior advisor, Kirsten Allen, her comms director, and Brian Fallon, her senior comms advisor. They swiftly activated a formidable political machine. There was a political operation in place that was minding her P's and Q's well ahead of the ticket switch, said an advisor. "We just were able to immediately utilize it for the sake of a whipping operation to secure the nomination." By that point, a dozen Harris advisors had joined the vice president around her dining room table. Laptops open, cell phones buzzing, they were wrangling support from around the country. Suddenly, Harris shouted, "Could someone please get a hold of my husband?" She'd called the second gentleman three times and got his voicemail. He was on a stationary bike at SoulCycle in San Francisco. Next, Harris stepped into the turret of the castle-like residence so she could speak without being overheard. First, she called Bill and Hillary Clinton. They offered their support and an immediate endorsement. She then called the Obamas. The 44th president was supportive, but said he wanted to wait a few days before endorsing her to avoid the appearance of a coronation. By now, Obama evidently preferred the appearance of a process to an actual open primary. Michelle was not only all in, she also offered to campaign with Harris, something she hadn't done for Biden. In the photo, at Howard University, Vice President Kamala Harris bid supporters farewell the day after her November defeat. Harris's next calls were to potential rivals for the nomination, Governors Roy Cooper, Josh Shapiro, Gretchen Whitmer, J.B. Pritzker, and Gavin Newsom. Some asked Harris what the process would be. She replied crisply that it should be settled in the normal way. Whoever earned a majority of the pledged delegates would win the nomination. Period. Cooper, Whitmer, Shapiro, and Newsom offered Harris their support that same day. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly followed suit. Outreach to potential running mates, she eventually chose Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, wouldn't begin for another week. Early in the afternoon, the enormity of what was happening struck Harris. It was a moment none of her advisors and friends would forget. The vice president called her pastor and put him on speakerphone. Reverend Amos C. Brown, 83, led Harris, Voles, Nix, and Allen in prayer, asking God for guidance and wisdom for the good of the country. "What does the Lord require of you but to do justice," he said, reciting from Micah 6:8, "and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God." The vice president was verklempt, in tears. "She welled up for sure," said an advisor. "We all did." By 10 p.m. at the Naval Observatory, jigsaw pieces were still strewn across the kitchen table, but the puzzle of Harris's nomination had been solved. She'd called more than 100 people. Not a single potential rival had challenged her. By Monday, Harris had the backing of a majority of Democrats in Congress. Within 48 hours, she had the support of most delegates who would be at the convention. A senior advisor summed up Harris's two-day marathon as a political tour de force. "A lot of people were like, 'We need a process.' Well, there is a process, getting the delegates to commit. We just needed to do it, and we did it." 107 days later, as history will recount, Team Harris hit rock bottom. Yet it didn't seem so as Election Day dawned. Though Harris was behind in the battleground states, her spokespeople were oddly upbeat. Appearing on MSNBC back on October 27th, campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon had declared, "We are very confident we're going to win this thing." On Friday, November 1st, senior advisor David Plouffe posted on X that late-breaking, undecided voters were going for Harris by more than 10 points. Next photo, after results came in late on election night, trash and dashed dreams littered the Howard University campus, site of the Harris campaign's headquarters. A campaign has a gravitational pull, and Chief of Staff Voles was feeling it. "You get sucked into the momentum," she said, "like you believe it. I've been on winning ones and losing ones, and this felt more like Bill Clinton's in 1992 than Michael Dukakis's in 1988. Voles wasn't taking poll numbers or analytics, but intangibles. The rallies were so big and so enthusiastic, people were lining the streets. But Harris's pollsters didn't share the kumbaya cohesion. One ex-Biden campaign official couldn't understand all the heady talk. They still had consistent polling results that showed her down by 2 in every state, she said, and Trump always overperforms. How the hell were they going to make that up? On election morning, Harris gathered with her family in the front part of the White House, while in the back, Nix, campaign chief of staff Voles, and others monitored returns. O'Malley, Dillon, and company were running the campaign nerve center at the Marriott Marquis Hotel near Howard University with an army of data crunchers, keeping Harris and her inner circle informed as returns came in. The vice president was hunkered down with her family. "We saw her maybe one time that whole night," said one of her close insiders, when the VP came back to their section of the house. As the evening wore on, it was just like, "What's going on?" The SG, second gentleman, would come in. Doug would say, "What's happening?" The realization grew that it was going to be a difficult night. One key indicator, Voles had summoned a photographer and a videographer. They were supposed to head to the Howard University campus with Harris for her victory speech. Instead, they cooled their heels. The moment of truth came just after midnight. O'Malley Dillon huddled with her two best analytics experts. They were her barometer, her North Star. And when they told her they did not see a path, O'Malley Dillon knew there wasn't one. She called the vice president. "We're down in the blue wall states, and we're not going to be able to make it up," she said. Oh, my God, said Harris. What is going to happen to this country? Suddenly, the race was over, as though someone had thrown a switch. We sent people home, said a Harris aide, and then find Cedric. Cedric Richmond, a Harris confidant, was tapped to deliver the bad news to the faithful at Howard University. He took the stage at 12:45 a.m. There would be no declaration of victory that night. There would be no Harris presidency. Just after 1 a.m., O'Malley Dillon faced one of her most daunting tasks. She had to call her 12-year-old twin daughters. They'd gone knocking on doors for Harris in Arizona that weekend and were totally invested in the campaign. They'd sent their mother a note saying they had to go to bed, but that they knew the numbers were going to turn for Harris. O'Malley Dillon called them on FaceTime to give them the news. And that was the moment when the steely Take No Prisoners campaign chair broke down. As Harris's devastated followers departed the campus courtyard, the ground was littered with discarded American flags and Harris Walls posters. The inspiring lightning speed campaign had imploded. So, too, in ways too numerous to count, had its defiant theme, "We are not going back." This article was from the forthcoming book, Uncharted, How Trump Beat Biden, Harris, and the Odds in the Wildest Campaign in History, by Chris Whipple. Copyright 2025 by C.C. Whip Productions, reprinted by permission of HarperCollins Publishers. In the next installment, we'll read about the fight between Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively, as well as this month's cover story with Gwyneth Paltrow. That and more in the next installment of Vanity Fair magazine. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.